it wouldn't even be possible for me to think of a better person to be greeting on Labor Day than you, Mike Rowe.
Well, okay? Thank you.
We're gonna get into the sweat pledge. We're gonna talk about a bunch of things. Stay tuned. We're gonna go to Colorado. Lori and I are gonna unpack a lot about what and who you are. Mike, why is this the perfect set, the perfect time, the perfect opportunity for you right here, right now?
I had the great good fortune 20 years ago to start a show called Dirty Jobs. Out of that show evolved a foundation called MicroWorks. MicroWorks was launched on Labor Day, 2008. It was a PR campaign for, at the time, a couple million good jobs that didn't require a four-year degree that nobody seemed to want. I thought it would be good to call attention to those jobs as best I could through this foundation. Over time, MicroWorks evolved into a trade resource center that helped hook people up with opportunities in their zip codes to weld, steam fit, pipe fit, plumbing, heating, air conditioning, electric, all that stuff. That's 15 years ago. The foundation continued to grow. We just gave away $1 million in work ethic scholarships last month. We'll do it again at the end of this year. So far, we've awarded over $7 million in these work ethic scholarships. Why work ethic? Because our country has a crisis right now. We have 11.2 million open jobs that don't require a four-year degree, that are just sitting there. So my foundation on this day is here to remind people that work ethic is still for sale. Our scholarship program has helped nearly 2,000 people at this point. There's got to be something in the good book about the dignity of work and the importance of showing up early and staying late and volunteering for the hard thing and treating the lower rungs on the ladder with the respect they deserve, knowing that it's impossible to climb without them.
Labor Day 2023. We're headed to Colorado. Our ride is here.
Why wait?
Tonight on Praise from Colorado, legendary TV host, writer, narrator, and producer, Mike Rowe. And now, Matt and Lori Crouch.
Mike Rowe.
Legendary Mike Rowe.
Legendary?
How did you get that title?
I think he gave it to me. There's clearly some sort of oversight.
We have been watching you on the Discovery Channel since my boys were about 10 years old and about 13 years old. We have virtually seen every single Dirty Jobs episode that there were. And
I enjoyed every moment.
Well, your taste is sophisticated and elevated, obviously, Lori.
So recently, you've been making the rounds in the news organizations. Mm-hmm. You're showing up and you're kind of talking about work. You're talking about work ethic. You're talking about skills gaps. Give us a minute of it. This is kind of a cathedral to work.
It is.
This is a working barn here in Colorado, and this is the perfect place to hear you talk. let me correct myself. Perfect place to hear you rant about this.
Well,
do it.
I don't want to rant, but here's the short version. Dirty Jobs was a tribute to my grandfather. He was a guy who we've discussed before who could build a house without a blueprint.
Yep.
Dropped out of the seventh grade to work. By the time he was 30, he could fix anything, build anything. That's what Dirty Jobs was a tribute to. 4 or 5 years into the show, I started a foundation called MicroWorks, which was sort of the next level of that celebration of work. MicroWorks evolved because work, in the eyes of many, has become the enemy. Mm-hmm. And that's an unfortunate thing. And so I began to look for jobs that existed that for whatever reason nobody was excited about pursuing. Those are the jobs in the skills gap. So back in 2008, those jobs consisted of 2.3 million opportunities. They didn't require a four-year degree. They required training. My organization is called MicroWorks. It's fundamentally a PR campaign for good opportunities that don't require a four-year degree, but do require a commitment to work and get trained. We're also a scholarship program today. We award $1 million a year to people who want to pursue these skills. And I'm here today because, unfortunately, it does seem as though work ethic and a lot of the things that we were all raised with, a lot of ideas like delayed gratification and a positive attitude and things like that, are under a weird kind of assault.
Wow.
Yeah.
That some kind of a red line that got crossed for you.
Yeah, for me, because, you know, one of the things we try and do in MicroWorks is affirmatively reward work ethic. And so we have a sweat pledge, among other things, that people need to sign if they want to apply for a scholarship. Well, in the past few months, it became obvious that some of the tenets in that pledge, some of the underlying philosophies that I hold dear, have in fact become questioned. And I'm not sure why, honestly, but it's happening. And so we're trying to push back a bit.
Okay, skill and work ethic aren't taboo. That's an acronym that spells what?
Yeah, well, it's sweat, you know. And look, this thing started very modestly. I just wanted to sit down and articulate a dozen qualities, a dozen attributes that I believe would help anybody succeed. And I had to call it something. And because our overarching assumption was that things like skill and work ethic were important but lacking, I called it the sweat pledge.
Yeah.
We've probably sold as a fundraiser maybe 20,000 of them so far. They hang in guidance counselors' office today. They hang in bedrooms. It's just an attempt to start a conversation around some of the ideas that are important to our foundation. If you haven't noticed, America is getting back to work. And if you're the kind of person who's willing to learn a skill that's in demand, the opportunities have never been better.
Work ethic is just a part of me, it just comes out naturally.
I knew I loved fixing things around my house.
Growing up, I always helped my dad.
It's kind of a joy to be able to see something not working and then after you touched it, it works.
When I was a kid, I used to purposely clog drains so I could have the maintenance guy come out to the apartments and look at how he was doing the work.
Everything that I worked for, everything that I studied, everything that I know is actually coming to good use.
If you don't go get it yourself, nobody's gonna give it to you, so. But you know it's like grindstone to make something for yourself.
I decided to go back to construction school. I think I can turn this into a hobby that pays.
I've made 4 times as much in this short amount of time than I made in a year at my previous job.
Have you ever met a welder that makes 6 figures?
Yes, I'm one of them.
I would challenge any woman that's watching a home improvement show. You can swing a 12-pound sledge and knock down a wall. And it's fun.
Don't be the best female welder. Be the best welder. And you cannot be denied.
Since I was little, I've had the dream of owning my own shop. And I don't think it's ever going to change.
So I started my own company about 3.5 years ago. From there, it's just been 6-7 days a week since.
Being a woman to own a construction company is the most empowering feeling.
Come on, America. Let's get back to work. Apply for a work ethic scholarship today at microworks.org.
How did this gap start? Give us a little bit of a, you know, I've heard you on news organizations say there's jobs waiting to be filled. And what happened? Why aren't they being filled?
Well, a couple things are happening. And I'm not an expert in it, but I'm pretty sure that it started with a well-intended attempt to give colleges a boost.
Okay.
Four-year schools needed a PR campaign back in the 60s. The country needed more people getting into a university. And so we pushed that hard. We pushed it very hard. unfortunately, part of the push was to say, if you don't go to a four-year school, you're going to wind up turning a wrench or operating any of the other tools you guys have here in this beautiful barn. And they made a whole category of jobs subordinate to one form of education. So the problem began when we elevated a four-year degree above all other forms of learning. The problem got worse when we took shop class out of high school. So now, by the time you get to the mid-late 70s, the best path for the most people is universally embraced as the most expensive path. Mm-hmm. And shop class, the best entryway for millions of people into the skilled trades, has been removed from high school.
Wow.
Consequently, over the next couple of decades, a lot of people borrowed a lot of money to pursue a four-year degree. And to your point, Matt, today we have 7 million open positions right now, the vast majority of which do not require a four-year degree. So to sum up, we are, as a country, lending a lot of money that we don't have to a lot of kids who are never going to be able to pay it back to educate them for careers that frankly don't exist anymore. It's a mismatch.
Yeah, and what's funny is that all I hear about what they're being taught in universities is...
not something maybe you want your kids to learn?
Yeah.
Look, it's a whole separate conversation, Laurie. We can talk about safe spaces, and we can talk about the snowflake culture.
Yeah.
And the universities have become, in my view, a pretty big and a pretty easy target. I don't really want to go there. You know, I'm the product of a four-year school. It served me well. But in 1984, when I graduated from a community college and then later a four-year school, my total bill was a little less than $12,000. Mm-hmm. Today, that same exact course load, those same studies from those same schools, just over 90 grand. So never in the history of our country has anything so important increased in cost so fast. The cost of a four-year degree has risen faster than real estate, food, energy, even healthcare. So we have this incredibly expensive thing. We have a lot of wonderful universities who have been incentivized to charge as much as they can because we have a bottomless well of money. And we've told a whole generation of kids, if you don't go in this direction, you're in terrible, terrible trouble.
You'll never get a job.
Let's not politicize this too much, but I do want to say this. When I was a young person, you know, when I was a teenager, I would turn on the TV and there would be all sorts of infomercials running for DeVry University, for, you know, truck driving schools, and you know, welding schools. There'd be all sorts of trade. So it was a thing when I was a teenager and a young adult to, hey, it was a career path at that point. Seems like that is just, that got, let's say, policied into oblivion.
It's not just the policy, it's our whole relationship with work. We are becoming a different kind of economy. We are relying on other countries to make our stuff and other people to serve us. Hmm. And so when we think of it like that, then whole categories of jobs become categorically unattractive to a lot of parents who want their kids to do something better than drive a truck or build a barn or lay a foundation. They want something better. The problem is they don't know what better is.
Yeah.
The myths, the misperceptions, the stigmas, and the stereotypes that routinely discourage millions of kids from exploring these trades, those things are real. And what my foundation tries to do with just simple facts and figures and say, is say, look at the data. Look at where the opportunities are. I can show you a path to a six-figure career that starts with a $6,000 welding certificate.
Wow.
I can show you the people who have taken that path.
Right.
I've interviewed many of them. So we just have to do a better job as a country, I think, in setting the table, making sure people understand where the opportunities are, and get rid of this stigma that if you don't have a four-year degree, you're somehow going to get the booby prize.
Yeah.
So if I was just tuning into this broadcast, it would feel like there was another shoe about to drop. Is it time? Can we announce your candidacy for president in 2024? Can we do that? Can we just please go ahead and do it?
I don't know what he's talking about. That's not happening.
Wait, did you say governor or president? Because you were telling me earlier something about running for something.
I'm just trying to get my show renewed, okay? And then maybe, you know, get the foundation to the
next level. So we're talking about a sweat pledge, and we want to start breaking it down. And then since everyone's like anticipating something, guess what? We want you to be involved in this sweat pledge. And so what we're going to talk about today is really a curriculum. We want to get some noise being made about this curriculum. Mike is all about work.
Yeah.
He's all about work ethic. And
so is more the Bible.
More than a decade ago, you created, you know, of course you're going to name it this, SWEAT Pledge. Okay, SWEAT, the acronym for Skill and Work Ethic Aren't Taboo.
My name is Jade, and this is Chuck, and we're both on the committee that reviews the Work Ethic Scholarship applications.
You did a great job. It was really, really great.
We wanted to let you know we loved your video. We thought your application was fantastic. You will be receiving a Work Ethic Scholarship.
Oh my God. Thank you guys so much.
And you will be a recipient this year.
Oh my God.
Gosh, thank you so much. It's very, very helpful.
Stop it. Oh my gosh. Stop it.
Thank you so much. I got it, Grandma. I got the scholarship.
We as a network want to be known about good, honest work. We want to be responsible for helping people understand that there are jobs waiting to be filled in the United States that don't need a four-year degree and to go into this massive debt to get them.
And can I just say something? I was sitting here a while ago thinking about all the prayer requests and yeah. comments that have come in through the 50 years now at TBN. I have read thousands of them saying, please pray that I can get a job, that I can find a job. I need a job. Pray that I can find a job. There are so many jobs. You know, and the Bible talks so much about whatever you do with your hands, do it as unto the Lord. And, you know, if they don't work, they shouldn't eat, and you should have plenty because of your work to feed others. You know, and so there's so much about this. And you've broke down your sweat pledge into 12 beautiful steps.
Yeah, but answer that whole, there's prayer requests coming in as we're sitting here.
Yeah. Sure.
About jobs. Yeah. Why? What's the problem here?
Because our fundamental relationship with work is broken, and our definition of what a good job is fractured. On my way here, I stopped in Denver, and I gave a talk to the National Flooring Association. There's an association for everything, and this association represents ma and pa companies that put your floors in, any kind of floor, from epoxy to wood to tile, whatever. These organizations, these companies, are small businesses. They estimate over the next 5 years, the companies represented at this conference I attended need to hire 180,000 people in 5 years. There's not a single place in the country right now that these people aren't aggressively hiring. And many of their programs start with apprenticeships at around $25 an hour. Their second giant problem, the government is paying tens of millions of dollars to people not to work. We are affirmatively discouraging the very thing we ought to be encouraging. Mm-hmm. And it's trickling down to the kinds of jobs that allow a barn like this to get built, a floor like this to get poured. And we're creating, I'm afraid, just a terrible problem. And it's not just for people who can't find work, Lori. And it's not just for employers who are struggling to find those people. In this case, it's for people who like floors.
Yeah.
Us,
yeah.
Right? We're talking about a workforce that's out of balance.
Yeah.
And if you don't think a skills gap is going to create real problems for anybody who shares my addiction to solid floors and indoor plumbing and reliable electricity and smooth roads and runways, we're all in this. So we have to think differently about work, and that's what my foundation does, and that's why I thought a sweat pledge might be a good way to start a conversation. Think about all we take for granted as a society. We're no longer impressed with smooth roads, sturdy foundations, affordable electricity, functioning red lights, or the miracle of modern plumbing. We're no longer gobsmacked by the fact that 1.5% of the population feeds 300 million people three times a day, right? We feel entitled to these things. Consequently, we don't really appreciate the people who make them all possible, even though we depend upon them. This overall lack of appreciation for skilled labor has fueled all kinds of myths and misperceptions that discourage people from exploring a legitimate opportunity in the trades. That's why we have millions of open jobs that nobody aspires to. The skills gap isn't a mystery. It's a reflection of what we value. And what we value is a reflection of what we're grateful for. That's why the Sweat Pledge starts with an attitude of gratitude. I believe I've won the greatest lottery of all time. I'm alive. I walk the earth. I live in America. Above all things, I'm grateful. If you don't agree with that, and if you don't agree with any of the other 11 tenets in the pledge, then what I politely tell those applicants is that this particular pile of free money is probably not for you. Yeah. And that's okay.
And that's a scholarship that is coming from your foundation.
Correct.
You just in case you didn't get it in one sentence, Micro has a foundation, Micro Works. He gives scholarships for people that want to get a good job, and you have to sign a sweat pledge. That was number one. Above all things, I'm grateful.
Right. You can't, in my opinion anyway, it's very difficult to feel sorry for yourself. Mm-hmm. It's very difficult to feel like a victim. It's very difficult to have a bad day if you are fundamentally grateful.
It's true.
For what you've got.
Yeah.
And look, this is not a new idea. I realize that. There's lots of biblical reference for it, and there's lots of common sense in it. But this notion, it's if you forget to be grateful for what you have, then you're, it's like when you're shooting at a target at a great distance. You know, if you're off just by a little tiny bit back here where the trigger is, by the time that bullet gets to where it's going, you'll miss it by a mile.
Yeah.
It has to start somewhere, and I think it starts with gratitude.
Yeah.
Number two.
I believe that I am entitled to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Nothing more. I also understand that happiness and the pursuit of happiness are not the same thing.
Correct. You have to enter the workplace and the education place with a realistic expectation. Nobody promised you a rose garden. You've got a chance to try. You have a chance to earn, to work, to experience. You have a choice to be curious or uncurious. But it really comes down to the old idea that equality is critically important when it comes to opportunity. Equality of opportunity matters. Equality of outcome, that's a dream. Mm-hmm. You can't guarantee the way a story ends. You can only be as fair as you can in making sure everybody has an honest shot. My first job required me to pick up vomit, clean toilets, the pay was lousy, and there were no benefits to speak of. And even though I worked 45 hours a week in the summer of 1980, I still didn't earn enough money to support myself. But that doesn't mean the job itself was bad, because without that job, I wouldn't have this job. Obviously, some jobs are more appealing than others. Some jobs pay better. Some jobs smell better. Some jobs are more dangerous. Some jobs are the rungs at the bottom of the ladder. But those jobs are actually the most important jobs, because a ladder with no rungs on the bottom is a very hard ladder to climb. Anyway, people love to talk about the differences between good jobs and bad jobs. It's a trap, because all jobs are opportunities. That's why there's no such thing as a bad job. I believe there's no such thing as a bad job. I believe that all jobs are opportunities, and it's up to me to make the best of them. Dirty Jobs was a love letter to work. It wasn't, oh no, look how dirty this job is. Mm-hmm. It was, yes, you're going to get dirty, but ask yourself what happens if those people don't show up mm-hmm. to do that job. Mm-hmm. Civilization, as we know it, goes straight off the rails. So number three is just a reminder to people that opportunity always precedes the job itself. And today, unfortunately, of all the many things that divide our country, the thing that worries me most is the number of people who genuinely believe that opportunity is dead.
Wow.
It's not dead. And the skills gap, more than anything else, 7 million jobs, makes me think that maybe opportunity is alive and well.
Skill and work ethic aren't taboo. Mike, we're breaking down the sweat pledge, and the point here is that we want people involved with it, okay? Mm-hmm. So there's all sorts of graphics on the screen, and we want people involved, and that's it. But number three particularly connects to what you did and what made you kind of a household name, which is mm-hmm. Dirty Jobs. Give a 30-second kind of backstory for those that haven't heard it on why Dirty Jobs even exists.
Oh, Dirty Jobs exists because my mother called me one day when I was working at CBS and she said, your father and your grandfather, in particular your grandfather, he's 91 years old. He's not going to be around forever. Wouldn't it be great if he turned on the TV one day and saw you doing something that looked like work? So the next day I took the cameraman into the sewers of San Francisco to profile a sewer inspector. That footage was disgusting and funny and weirdly important. I didn't know it was important. All I knew was I cut it together and put it on the air. And the next day I started getting hundreds of letters from people saying, hey, you think that's disgusting? You should meet my uncle, my brother, my cousin, my sister, my mom, right? Wait till you see what they do. And I realized, this is back in 2002, there was a hunger in the country for people to share their work. And somehow or another, TV had ignored that.
Wow.
So I thought it might be fun to go to places TV cameras never go, to meet people who are never profiled, to get an honest understanding of what work looked like. That show was rooted in modesty and based on humility and giving the viewer an honest look at what work looked like.
So every job matters.
Every job matters. It was way over 100 degrees down there, and the smell was much worse than anything I'd ever encountered before or since. Through it all, though, Les cracked jokes and laughed and told stories about his favorite customers. At one point, dehydrated and covered in other people's poop, I looked over at Les and I said, Les, how did you wind up here exactly? Les shrugged and said, I don't know. I just wanted to try something new. This was a job that needed doing. What would you do before this? I asked. I was a psychologist, he said. You're kidding. You retired from psychology to clean septic tanks? Why? Without missing a beat, Les smiles and says, I guess I got tired of dealing with other people's crap. People love to say, follow your passion. It's got a nice ring to it. But if you're looking to be satisfied in your work, why wait for your dream job? Why not be passionate about the job you have right now? When Les Swanson decided to try something new, at 55 years of age, he didn't search his heart to identify his wish fulfillment. He just looked around and found a job that needed doing. Once he found that, he got the training he needed. Then he went to work. Then he learned to love it. Today, Les has a business that's all his own and genuine job satisfaction. But make no mistake, he didn't follow his passion into a septic tank. He brought it with him and prospered as a result. I do not follow my passion. I bring it with me. I believe that any job can be done with passion and enthusiasm. Yeah, that's an important one, and it's a big problem for a lot of people. A lot of people hitch on that one because we're told today that the key to happiness, the key to job satisfaction, is to first identify the thing that will make you happy. Mm-hmm. Then we embark on this great quest to get to that place. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, that quest often involves borrowing large sums of money to go to a school somewhere to spend 4 years. Some would say getting indoctrinated. Others would say getting a broad-based liberal arts education. Call it what you will. By the time you get through that, now you've got your debt and you've got your degree, and now you go out into the world to try and find the thing that's going to make your passion sing, right?
Wow.
But it's all backwards. Mm-hmm. The big lesson on Dirty Jobs was those people were happy. They were all passionate about what they did. But nobody was doing anything that the average person would look at and say, oh yeah, that's what I want to do, including them. So in a very general way, what I'm trying to say with that one is don't identify your passion first. Identify the opportunities first. Mm-hmm. See where that takes you. Then find a way to get really good at what you're doing, and then find a way to love it. Mm. You'll wind up in the same place.
Yeah. Nice. Number five.
Number five. I deplore debt and do all I can to avoid it. I would rather live in a tent and eat beans than borrow money to pay for a lifestyle that I can't afford.
All right. Yeah. I got a little cheeky with that one. But listen, it's important when we talk about education, because when I question the wisdom of a 4-year degree for everyone, what often comes back to me is Mike's anti-college, Mike's anti-education. I'm not. Nothing could be further from the truth. But I am anti-debt. Mm-hmm. And debt was the only 4-letter word in my house that was really, you know, that was the bad one. You know, my father couldn't tolerate it, couldn't have it. Now, there were times when we had to have some, but by and large, I just grew up with the level of rectitude and fear around debt. And so it served me well. You know, when I went to school, I had some help from my dad, but back then again, it was $26 a credit. You know, I could swing it. I could afford to experiment. I could try things I might otherwise not. Debt wasn't a big concern, but it's a massive concern today. And when I look at the number of people who are starting their careers, 120, 150, $200,000 in debt, it's heartbreaking. They're not going to get out of that hole.
Yeah.
And in the end, it's going to fall to other people to pay for that.
Yeah.
Whew. I grew up in the same vibe. My dad was just, whew.
When your upkeep exceeds your income, your upkeep becomes your downfall.
Perfect.
Not bad. I should have written that.
I think.
Number six.
I think you did. I believe that my safety is my responsibility. I understand that being in compliance does not necessarily mean I'm out of danger.
That's also a problem for a lot of people. Mm-hmm. There's a safety first mentality in our country. Mm-hmm. And there's a safety first dogma in most vocational jobs, and OSHA is there to enforce it. These things are all well intended. In no way do I encourage unnecessary risk or people taking needless chances. However, something gets lost when we say that when a company tells an employee that their safety is the most important thing. That's not really how the world works. That's not what work really is. Risk is real.
Right.
Risk is always out there. It's certainly always on the job. So this leads to a much larger and longer conversation about the unintended consequences of telling somebody that their safety is the most important thing. It fosters a sense of complacency, and ultimately, it puts people in danger. Unless we assume a measure of personal responsibility for our own well-being, we are never going to be safe. The truth is, the dirty truth, is we're never safe anyway.
Yeah.
It's balance, it's prudence, it's caution mixed with a desire to get the job done. Safety, while critically important, is not the reason we live. Imagine if Jesus of Nazareth had gone through his life saying safety first.
Yeah.
Yeah, right.
Most important thing is not to get hurt. Let's all be as careful as we can. Are you kidding me? Everything in that book on your lap comes down to a willingness to assume a measure of personal responsibility and risk. But boy, in my world, in the world of work, the way those two things come together, for me, it's a cheerful willingness to understand the world is a dangerous place. And people have sacrificed for you. You know, your parents, your coworkers.
Exactly. Okay. But putting others first. I'm worried about you first. That was always
seriously, we
Jesus
could derail on number
okay.
six.
For all right. The,
okay. I feel like we might.
Okay. Number like seven.
We're going to have to kind of go speed round.
Okay,
now.
I believe the best way to distinguish myself at work is to show up early, stay late, and cheerfully volunteer for every crappy task there is. That's what every person in this room does.
I made your wife say crappy on TVN.
You did. You did. And I'm sorry for that. But it was, sorry. I don't have my glasses on. I could have edited that.
It's crappy.
Look,
crappy.
I mean every word of that. It's again, this is not advice that I feel like a lot of kids get, but everybody in my foundation has to sign that.
Yeah.
It's not I don't want you to show up on time. I don't want you to leave when the whistle blows. I want you to be there early and I want you to stay late. And it's like when you're having a dinner party and one of your guests stands up and starts starts doing the dishes. Well, I know you, Lori, that horrifies you. You're like, no, you sit down. But I bet there's a part of you inside that goes, you know what?
Go get your own fork, Mike.
Yes. Send me in there to get my own
night.
Fork.
It's in the drawer on the right.
I think as an employer,
yes.
When somebody in my organization does that, goes above and beyond without asking, without looking for a reward, I remember that.
Yeah.
And I got news for you. Every employer in the country does too.
Yeah.
And if you really want to get up those rungs faster, just be mindful of it. Put yourself in my place. You're all stressed out because a crowd of fans are making you late for an appearance. You're annoyed, right? Because no one has arranged for transportation and you have to walk half a mile through a crowd to get to where you need to be. Then suddenly you're face to face with a guy who has no arms or legs, who wants to tell you how lucky he is. A guy who went to war on your behalf, comes home with none of his limbs, and wants you to know how much he appreciates what you did for him. I learned that day that Staff Sergeant Travis Mills was missing more than his original parts. He was missing all trace of self-pity. And that's a quality I admire. We've stayed in touch over the years, me and Travis, and recently I had a chance to visit him up in Maine, where he's built a retreat for other servicemen and women who sustained similar injuries in the war. He's the same guy, unflaggingly cheerful, incredibly stubborn, and incapable of whining or complaining. His attitude is the living embodiment of the sweat pledge. And his life begs two really simple questions. If he can get through the day without whining or complaining, why can't I? With respect, why can't anyone? I believe the most annoying sounds in the world are whining and complaining. I'll never make them. And if I am unhappy in my work, I'll either find a new job or I'll find a way to be happy.
Amen.
It speaks for itself.
Yeah.
You know,
go be happy. Find something you love to do.
Right.
Yeah.
Look, you said earlier you're getting tens of thousands of requests
for people looking for work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How in the world can that be going on at a time when so many people seem so unhappy in their work? When did work become the enemy?
Yeah. Wow.
When did that happen? I'm not exactly sure, but I'm pretty sure it has.
Number nine,
I believe that my education is my responsibility and absolutely critical to my success. I am resolved to learn as much as I can from whatever source is available to me. I will never stop learning and understand that library cards are free.
So that's in there, honestly, because I got so tired of the criticism of saying, no, Mike, he's anti-education. Mm-hmm. I just don't know how many times I can say it. You have no hope today without an education in the workforce. But an education is not the sole province of a four-year degree. I put library card in there because I knew it would make my dad laugh, but the truth is, I was thinking about this.
Yeah, sure.
I have access with this thing, this yes. and an internet connection to 99.6% of all the known information in the history of the world. So if I'm curious, there are so many ways to scratch that itch, you know, and it's ridiculous, dangerous, and irresponsible to think there's only one place to get smart. Not long ago, my foundation gave a work ethic scholarship to a guy named John Fitzpatrick. John Fitzpatrick was one of the best applicants we've ever seen. There was just one problem. John Fitzpatrick was a convict, still behind bars. I get it. Jail time looks very bad on a resume, and it looks bad on a scholarship application, too. The question is, why is it on either? I mean, why do we force former offenders to check the box every time they apply for a job? What's the point in paying your debt to society if society never forgives the loan? Recidivism rates are through the roof today. 76% of offenders wind up back in jail within 5 years of their release. Unless we're willing to lock up every criminal forever, the real question becomes, what's best for society? I mean, who would you rather live next to? A former convict who has a useful skill and a full-time job? Or a former convict with no skill, no prospects, and no hope of reassimilating? I believe John Fitzpatrick is a product of the choices he's made. But I don't think his past choices should define him for the rest of his life. He's paid his debt to society, and I believe his new choices will lead to better circumstances. In fact, I'm kind of counting on it. I believe I'm the product of my choices, not my circumstances. I'll never blame anyone for my shortcomings or the challenges I face, and I'll never accept the credit for something I didn't do.
Wow.
I like that.
Yeah, so it's just an attempt to remind the signer that whatever you're dealing with, somebody's dealing with something worse.
Number 11.
I understand the world is not fair, and I'm okay with that. I do not resent the success of others.
Yeah, not a popular sentiment today, yeah. But it is part of the sweat pledge.
Yeah.
You know.
The sweat pledge, Mike Rowe, because of his foundation, because of years on television and doing the work on Dirty Jobs, came up with a beautiful acronym, SWEAT. Skill and work ethic aren't taboo. We're breaking it down. The reason we're sitting here talking about it is it's important, but we want you involved, and we are, in essence, agreeing to work on a curriculum together, get this visual curriculum known, his foundation. If you sign this sweat pledge and do some other things, you have to apply and all that, you're giving out grants and scholarship pieces for trade schools and this kind of thing. We love all that. And thank you for Dirty Jobs, all 9 billion episodes of them that have been running virtually every day for the last 2 decades. Let's get to 12 so that we can break down the entire 12. You know, What did you call this yesterday sitting around dinner? You called this kind of a cross between the Ten Commandments, the
Ten
Boy
Commandments,
Scout Pledge,
the Scout Law.
The Scout Law.
And the 12-step recovery process.
Yeah, okay, so we're on number 12.
We threw in the Apostles' Creed.
Yeah, that works too.
Yeah.
I believe that all people are created equal. I also believe that all people make choices. Some choose to be lazy. Some choose to sleep in. I choose to work my butt off. You made me say butt.
I made you say crap and butt. Yeah. It's a big day for me. Look, it's just, again, it's a shameless attempt to get people to think seriously about what they're applying for, right? This is a work ethic scholarship. And so I didn't want to pull any punches. I wanted to be as clear as I could, but I also wanted to do it cheerfully.
Yeah.
This is a cheerful pledge. Yeah. It's not a finger-shaking old man on the porch yelling at the kids to get off his lawn. At least I hope I'm not. You know,
you
okay,
are
boomer.
That, you right. are that a little.
I am, okay. You know
like
what?
It.
I'm getting more and more. I'm turning into that guy. But look, I know what worked for me.
Yeah.
I know how I was raised. I believe these qualities are still for sale. I don't believe they're being taught in schools.
Right.
And so those 12 points that you just read are now a 200-page curriculum that's in a pilot program in 30 or 40 trade schools. And look, if I get my way, it'll be in schools everywhere.
Yeah.
It'll be in companies, yeah. Maybe even for homeschooling and
But I
so
believe
forth.
We're hearing the loudest voices raging, let's
that's
put it
correct.
That way. And so rage is the thing right now. But I think most good America-loving people believe in this. Still, I believe that they're out there. I believe that they're everywhere. And I pray that they stand up for things like this and just support things like this. You don't have to rage
be
to be heard. Mm. The Bible talks about the quietness of your spirit and the gentle answer and the gentle tones. And so the people that are raging about things, their voices come and they will go. But the people that are strong and believe in those are godly principles, Mike.
Well, I guess I just plagiarized the Bible. Oh, am I in trouble?
For about what, the fourth time?
Look, patience.
Yeah.
There's nothing in the Bible that's new, and there's nothing in the sweat pledge that's new. But to everything a season.
Yes.
Yeah.
And sometimes with Dirty Jobs, the headlines caught up to my show and made me relevant in a way I didn't mm-hmm. think I ever would be. The same thing is happening now. Some ideas that we hold dear have fallen out of favor. Times change, you know. Be of good cheer, sit tight, hold fast. That's all those ideas are baked into this.
Yeah.
Okay, so the big announcement around here that we wanted to do is we wanted to mention that this location that we've been doing this praise program is a barn. And it is kind of our cathedral to work, okay? It's meaningful to us. We've sat here now for a number of days. And can you explain or help me explain to Lori what the show is?
Okay. Well,
yeah, explain to me.
The show that Matt's talking about, Lori,
okay. mm-hmm.
is based on my podcast.
Right. Yes.
And my podcast is called The Way I Heard It.
Yes. Right.
And it consists of short mysteries.
Right.
True stories you didn't know about famous people you do.
Yes.
So you listen to these stories and you get to try and figure out who I'm talking about, like the old Paul Harvey. Well, your husband loves these stories.
Right.
And he wanted to sit down and talk to me about why I wrote them.
Yeah.
And so that's what we do on this set.
Okay, but before we get there, remember I came to you and I said, I like your podcast the yes. way I heard it.
Yes,
do you remember?
I do.
Let's get on the same page.
Yes, I remember.
That happened?
Yes, it happened.
Okay, and I said, why don't we put visuals to it?
Yes.
And what did you say?
I was skeptical because I thought bringing visuals to this show would wreck it.
Would you confirm, sir, that that's your handwriting?
Yes, I wrote this just the other day.
And could you read it for the audience, please?
Show that to the camera right here. There you go.
As it turns out, my stories can be brought to life through a series of highly produced reenactments with wonderful actors. And Matt Crouch made that happen and cut it together with me telling these stories. And as it turns out, their modesty aside, actually quite good, which is a long way of saying I was wrong and Matt was right.
Thank you. We'll be putting that up here in the cathedral to work.